From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In breaking news Friday, Telesur reports that Mexico's Attorney General, Jesus Murillo Caram, was expected to step down from his post after being under fire for months over his handling of the investigation into the disappearance and apparent massacre of 43 student teachers. That according to a senior government official. Various news reports confirmed the information and said the Attorney General's office had set a news conference for late Friday to announce the changes. As of press time, no further information was available. Syria's UN ambassador has accused the West and certain regional countries of worsening the humanitarian situation in the country by supporting anti-government terrorist groups.
We cannot speak of improving the humanitarian situation while weapons and training are still being provided to terrorists under the slogan of moderate opposition. In other words, we have to put an end to the practices of the Turkish, Qatari, Saudi, Israeli terrorist alliance, which is supporting, funding, and arming ISIL, Nusra Front, and the Free Army, and the other terrorist groups that are embracing the ideology and praxis of Al-Qaeda.
Jaafari said the former U.S. ambassador to Syria recently admitted that the so-called moderate opposition is collaborating with the Al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front. He also said the West and some regional countries are the reason terrorist groups still exist in the region. He noted that civilians have been the main target of airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition in the country. Jaafari warned the international community that museums are being targeted by terrorists because they have found customers in the West. Meanwhile, a solidarity delegation of U.S. activists, sponsored by the anti-war organization International Action Center, was in Damascus Thursday. The delegation condemned U.S. intervention in the Syria conflict. Telesur's Nashwan Abdullah reports from Damascus.
The mission toured the Umayyad Mosque, an important holy site in Syria, and they witnessed the resilience of the Syrian people despite continued hardships. Many participants on the delegation expressed their concerns about the role of the U.S. government and other nations in perpetuating the conflict.
Well, there's a coalition of countries led by the United States that are enforcing sanctions against Syria, enticing defections of noted intellectuals from Syria, and that are also supplying weapons to the terrorists who are terrorizing the population of Syria.
Syria has full education and full health care and many things with its resources that the U.S. wants to change and Saudi Arabia wants to change. And because Syria has been steadfast for Palestine, and therefore Israel is determined also to destroy Syria. So there is a reactionary evil alliance, a conspiracy against Syria.
The Minister of Justice, Najm Hamad Al-Hamad, met with the delegation and acknowledged that the war against Syria is breaching all the international rules through aiding the terrorist rebels who will only further destabilize the region. Mr. Ramsey Clark, the head of the delegation, sees that conflict must stop for the sake of innocent people.
But you can't go on forever. You've got power and numbers beyond the capacity of Syria to resist. So people who want peace, people who love children, better stand up now and say no more, not another foot.
This was not the first recent international delegation to Syria. Members of the French Congress visited Syria on Sunday and had important meetings with the Syrian government about reconsidering their relations with Syria.
On Thursday, lawyers for imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal presented their case at a hearing in the federal courthouse in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, seeking to block a new Pennsylvania law that would allow the government to censor inmates and the news media. The law, called the Revictimization Relief Act, was enacted in response to Abu-Jamal's October commencement speech at Goddard College and is an apparent attempt to prevent him and other state inmates from having a public voice. Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan, who's been recording Abu-Jamal's commentaries for many years, was at the hearing and gave us this update by telephone Friday. So what happened in court yesterday?
Prison Radio, as represented by the Amistad Law Project and the Abolitionist Law Center, along with David Shapiro from the Roderick and Solange Justice Center out of Northwest University, were in court, in federal court, before Chief Justice Christopher O'Connor in the federal court, trying to get a preliminary injunction against this new law, the Silence Mumia law that was passed in Pennsylvania in October. So we're in court. Now, interestingly, the judge said that he would only accept arguments about standing, whether or not we could bring this to this court and actually attack the law right now. So that happened for 2 hours in court in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we think it went very, very well. The judge had some very specific questions for the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, their representatives, and also for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. He questioned whether the District Attorney and the Attorney General both said that they weren't going to enforce the law, that there was no credible threat, that there had to be adverse parties for there to be standing. And what we said was there's already an adverse threat because the law is now in force. It's actually preventing some media outlets from doing commentaries. It's affecting the inmates inside with the threat. And then the Attorney General and the AG said that they had no intention of pursuing this law. And the District Attorney's Office even went so far as to say that they had no opinion on whether this law was constitutional or not. So that was fascinating.
Mm.
Now, as we all know, the Department of Corrections has an enormous amount of control of the inmates that they house.
Right.
And they have many tactics and strategies for preventing people from getting access to the outside world. And they are currently denying Mumia Elujumal and other Pennsylvania prisoners today the ability to call prison radio. So I've been working through tech support and administrative remedies and documentation. So they are taking extra legal actions to prevent Mumia from calling, but they so far can't take legal actions to prevent him, or we're in court again to try and prevent them from taking legal actions. We have to continually battle the prison for access every day for phone access to prisoners, and we're doing that. We are consistently advocating for our right and your right as listeners to hear this material. So it's a pretty big burden on us, but we are committed to doing it because really we need that information.
As we reported earlier this week, the pullback of heavy artillery from the front lines in Ukraine's civil war is well underway, and the fighting has come almost to a halt. That was confirmed Friday in a video conference presentation to the UN Security Council by senior officials of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE. The officials said that despite considerable progress, the package of measures recently agreed to in Minsk needs to be fully implemented. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
In her briefing to the Security Council, Ambassador Heidi Tagliavini of Switzerland, who chairs the OSCE's contact group on Ukraine, stressed the need for the guns to be silent in eastern Ukraine. She pointed out that when the first ceasefire agreement was signed in Minsk in September last year, the death toll of the conflict already stood at around 3,500.
5 months later, when the implementation package was signed in Minsk on 12 February and the declaration of the four heads of state and government was agreed upon, the death toll was already close to 6,000, not mentioning those missing in action.
Ambassador Tagliavini said today there is a de-escalation of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, which she hoped might become an irreversible process.
A sustainable ceasefire and a continued process of de-escalation, including the withdrawal of heavy military equipment, are, in our opinion, the indispensable prerequisites to any further progress on the way toward a peaceful settlement. Let me repeat this. Unless the guns fall silent, there will be no hope for stabilizing the situation, let alone for peace.
Over the past 2 days, government and rebel forces have taken steps to comply with the Minsk Agreement, said Ambassador Ertugrul Apakan, the head of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine, SMM. Ambassador Apakan said the SMM is ready to carry out its responsibility of monitoring and verifying the withdrawal of heavy weapons from a defined security zone.
On 13 February, immediately after the conclusion of the package of measures, we wrote to the signatories to make clear what information is needed from them if SMM is to conduct this work. This includes what heavy weapons they have, where these weapons are now, and which routes will be used to withdraw them, and where they will be located after they have been withdrawn. The parties have provided answers, but the information received is not yet sufficient.
Ambassador Apakan stressed that a full and unconditional ceasefire remains what he described as the foundation for the further implementation of the Minsk Accords. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Many of those with an understanding of the history and politics of the region find it difficult to be optimistic about Ukraine's prospects despite the ceasefire. Ukraine's history has, for most of the past 1,000 years, been Russia's history, and where the country had its own nation-state apart from Russia, it was bitterly divided by ideology and issues of ethnic identity. Peter Laveau is an American author, journalist, and academic who lives in Russia. He hosts the program Crosstalk for RT. This past week, he and his guests discussed the just-past 70th anniversary of the Yalta Conference, held in the closing months of World War II, where U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Soviet Prime Minister Joseph Stalin laid out the groundwork for the post-war world order, including the structure of the United Nations and the post-war map of Europe that held for almost a half a century thereafter. They discussed how the unraveling of that order over the past 25 years has brought Ukraine to disaster and Europe to the brink of war. We spoke with them via Skype from Moscow Friday. So, Peter, the last two editions of Crosstalk sort of show an interesting intersection of history passing by us and current events, with the 70th anniversary of the Yalta Conference, which took place, by the way, in Crimea,
yes,
when Crimea was part of Russia, hosted by Joseph Stalin, with Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill there, essentially mapping out the post-war conditions for Europe and the general agreement on the establishment of the United Nations, which was undertaken in earnest 2 months later in San Francisco. That, and how it relates to current events in Ukraine, was deep discussion in the two episodes of Crosstalk. You want to talk about some of this stuff?
Yeah, it's really interesting. First, I think our listeners will like to know, I mean, I was an academic historian before I got into this media business, is that when Roosevelt's plane was being guided to Yalta, Stalin made sure that the Red Army, the Air Force, made sure they were major detours, made the flight very long for Roosevelt, not to punish his friend, but to make sure that Roosevelt, at a low altitude, could see the amazing devastation inflicted by on the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany. And personal reports is that Roosevelt was quite taken aback. He was actually in a state of shock. He had never seen or even conceived of that kind of construction, destruction in a modern war. And so when he landed in Yalta, Stalin, you know, basically, how was the flight, Franklin? And he said, very, you know, very telling, very informative. It's very interesting. The reason why I did the program on Yalta is that so many people don't realize that Yalta was an amazing success,
right,
not a failure. It's coming apart because Western powers are destroying it, because the Soviet Union and today's Russia are fundamentally status quo powers. They Russia wants to keep what it has.
Right.
It's not an expansionist power.
Right.
And when we have the Western powers go into the Ukraine, destabilize it, and overthrow the democratically elected government, that is an assault on Yalta that was decided 70 years ago. And of course, Western reading of Yalta is completely opposite. It's considered complete appeasement of Stalin, and Stalin gave up so much to have peace and to quote-unquote keep what he thought he earned as a result of the Second World War.
You know, almost contemporaneously with, I guess it was a little bit prior, but while the negotiations and the discussion of post-war arrangements were being held in advance of that, in early 44, mid-44, there was a soft coup in the United States. There were two trends looking towards the post-war period. One looking at a true partnership with Russia, and the other looking at, and ultimately winning, conducting a Cold War or worse against Russia, looking at the Soviet Union as an adversary. Then they were represented in the bodies of Henry Wallace, who was the vice president through 1944, and Harry Truman, who ended up in an upset, and despite the wishes of most of the delegates at the Democratic National Convention, ended up as the vice presidential candidate and a few months into the term president.
Right. It's that is very true, because you have very different possible historical outcomes there. If Wallace had been able to maintain his position there, we might have avoided the Cold War altogether. Again, if we look at the entire history of the 40 years of the Cold War in Europe, the Soviet Union didn't move one inch. As a matter of fact, let's remember that Khrushchev said, look, let's demilitarize, depoliticize, neutralize Austria, a step in the right direction of goodwill. Can we do that? And maybe we can move forward. And of course that happened, but the West drew the wrong conclusions. He must be weak. He isn't in control at home, et cetera, et cetera. And the West always drew the wrong conclusions and always reacted with more militarism, more missiles. I can remember in the 1980s, the whole debate about intermediary missiles in Europe. We're going to come back to that because the United States is saying it may move out of that regime as well. So this lost opportunity. And I'm very depressed right now, because you see Europe, they're doing everything they can to defuse, de-escalate the crisis in Ukraine, and it's the United States. It's quite galling. Is that the economy now is officially dead in Ukraine? The currency is officially dead, and the only thing John Kerry can talk about is getting more funding to fight quote unquote RT's propaganda war and more arms for Kyiv. It's complete lunacy.
Yeah. There's nothing about trying to jumpstart the economy and looking at the war as a tremendous drain on it. Now, just for our listeners, at Yalta, what was decided was the more or less the relative influence of the two blocs, you know, of the United States and Britain on the one hand and of the Soviet Union on the other, in a number of the buffer states, and then the configuration of Germany itself, which led to ultimately Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Bulgaria, Romania, being sort of buffers between the two, Germany being divided into four zones, but ultimately into east and west, and the governments in the western part being under the influence of the United States, because you had large communist parties at the time in Italy, France, and other
places,
and Greece. And as a matter of fact, what's happening in Greece now also is sort of a replay of what happened in the immediate post-war period, where Stalin had conceded Western influence to Greece, and despite the fact that the Greeks almost accomplished a communist revolution in their own country and was only put down by the UK and the US.
Exactly. You know, Don, one of the things, one of the great myths about the post-war period and the result of the Yalta Agreement is that, first of all, you know, in Western literature, in hysterics, they always look at Poland. Well, the government in exile in London was not elected by anyone
That's right.
at all. As a matter of fact, it represented the most reactionary, anti-democratic, militaristic, and anti-Semitic elements of Polish society.
That's right.
They were not elected by anyone. And they were not representative of Polish society. And what they did was they polarized Polish society and Western media and the establishment in Washington about the meaning of these Poles in exile. Now, I'm going to be the first to say, because this is what I did my PhD studies, and I know Eastern European history well during the Cold War. And yes, there was, because of historical reasons, an antipathy towards Russia because of, we go back to the Napoleonic Wars, when armies go over your country back and forth, they leave a lot of chaos. That's the nature of war. A lot of these populations did not have fond memories of the Russians, though let's not underestimate how many of them were grateful of the Red Army freeing them from Nazi tyranny.
That's right.
Now, I lived in Poland. I lived in Poland for quite a few years when it was still under communist rule, Don. And I want our viewers, listeners, to understand is it's not as black and white as the West always likes to portray these countries.
That's right.
As a matter of fact, I likened living in Poland in the 1980s to pretty much what it was like in the early 1770s. In the United States, or what would become the United States, is that one-third were for very much British rule, one-third wanted independence, and one-third sat on the fence. And that's what it was like living in Poland in the 1980s. I knew a lot of people say, well, I'm going to go wherever the direction of whatever happens. I'll go with that.
Right. Yeah.
And, of course, I knew many people in the Solidarity movement. But it wasn't black and white. And let's remember, let's not forget, all of these regimes in Eastern Europe that were a result of the Yalta Agreement had quite willing people that would work with Soviet with the Soviet Union and with Soviet officialdom in Moscow. There were no shortage of people that wanted to do that. Let's not forget that. I traveled all through Eastern Europe in the 1980s, and it was not a prison camp. It wasn't a gulag.
Right, right.
As a matter of fact, if you went to Czechoslovakia in the 1980s, it was kind of a nice place to be because you didn't have all this Western advertising and wastefulness and stuff that you don't need. It was actually quite enriching. I liked it. And I'll tell you, a lot of people in Eastern Europe today have fond memories of those days.
You know, there's symbols of it in the kitsch culture, like the Trebi is popular again amongst some circles as a little hip automobile. I was in Krakow for a short while in 1990 and in Prague a couple times in 1990. So it was just after they had left the Warsaw Pact. And, you know, talking with people there, there were people that were anxious about what was happening and preferred the order that they had before. And by the way, from these communist hellholes a few months later, these were beautiful, comfortable, human, livable, wonderful cities, compared to... I didn't see homeless people. I didn't see anxiety on people's faces.
You know what? You look at all of these countries prior to 1939. You look at levels of literacy. We don't think about that when we think of Europe, right?
Right.
But levels of literacy were not that high in many countries in Eastern Europe.
Right.
The level of unemployment, the difference in income distribution. I mean, all of the things that plague Western societies today plague Eastern Europe today. I find it quite hilarious is that there are people like Ed Lucas at The Economist saying that Russia is eyeing the Baltic republics. Well, look at the demographics of the Baltic republics in the last 25 years. Even young people in the Baltic republics don't want to live in the Baltic republics.
Right,
they're leaving. Why in the world would Russia want it? Because of these neoliberal policies that have just totally destroyed these really nice, quaint little countries. I knew the Baltic republics quite well. I understood the historical differences with Moscow and their desire to be independent. I always supported that. I always thought that should be a good idea because that was self-determination that was very transparent, very obvious. And now, you know, they turn to to the IMF, to the World Bank, and all these other institutions. And you know what? These countries are nasty little places to live now because their economies are so distorted now. Get Michael Hudson on your program. He's an expert on this. He's been on Crosstalk many times. So again, you know, when we look at the outcomes of Yalta, it stood for many decades, and it kept peace in Europe. We forget that. People forget that. It kept peace in Europe. And now, for the first time since the Second World War, we're looking at a major, and I'm not forgetting about what happened in Yugoslavia, but that was quite contained. But now we're looking at, because of this lunatic regime installed by lunatic regime in Kiev, installed by lunatics in Washington, we are looking at a possible confrontation, and it's quite serious.
Yeah, it's very serious. Yeah, you guys went in depth in the program about Yalta, about how it's being dismantled and how it's been dismantled. If you look for the historical context for people, first of all, there's a historical antipathy against both Germany and Russia in varying degrees, because Russia has been invaded by Germany and France a number of times historically, and the battlefield ends up being these countries in between. Poland and the Baltic states and Hungary and, you know, et cetera. So every time these folks in the middle think of Russia or Germany, they think of devastation and war. And
yes, but Don, this is another problem coming from the West, not from Russia. Let's look right after the First World War, because of Wilsonian principles, and we should have a program on that, because this is Wilson got us into most of this mess, okay, at the end of the day. Very highfalutin ideas, very bad politics. What happened? They bring into being all these countries in Eastern Europe. They're weak. Their sovereignty is weak. Their legitimacy, even within the borders of their countries, is weak because we have so many minorities. It's no coincidence we had empires in that part of the world.
Right.
It's no coincidence that the Austro-Hungarian Empire lasted so long because there was not a better alternative to it. So after the First World War, we have all of these weak countries. And if I've been sitting in Budapest or in Prague or Warsaw, and all of a sudden the French start building the Maginot Line, I would have said, they're going to protect themselves. They're not going to protect us from the Germans or the Russians, okay? They had the Second World War. And this is what Yalta tried to alleviate. These countries are still weak. Now, they've been ethnically cleansed, yes. That gives them unfortunately, because of that tragedy, they have more legitimacy at home because they're more their ethnic makeup is more. You have majority societies, but the Yalta system was saying now we have to keep these in place. And believe it or not, the Yalta system protected the sovereignties of these countries to one degree or another. I'm not overlooking Czechoslovakia in 1968. I'm not looking over Hungary in 1956. No. But more or less, for almost a half century, the sovereignties of all of these countries were maintained. They were intact. And I would say it's directly because of what was negotiated at Yalta. Let's take the example of Poland. I mean, people want to say this is the example of appeasement to Stalin and to the Soviet Union. But at the end of the day, is it realistic to look at a group of people that were undemocratically elected, were not representative of Polish society, living in London, to unravel the outcome of the Second World War? It was extremely unrealistic. That's why every single president, from Truman all the way to Reagan, you know, they might say things about, democracy and civil rights and human rights and all that, but they were very rational at the end of the day. Said, we're not going to go to war with a nuclear, we're not going to create a confrontation, a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union, a nuclear power. Today, in 2015, Russia is a nuclear power. As a matter of fact, our listeners should remember, Russia has more nuclear weapons now than the United States. Keep that in mind.
Right.
And keep it in mind, there's a president of Russia that has said he has red lines and they will not be crossed. this person is to be taken seriously, not these Victorian Newlands in the United States. The thing is that the Yalta system worked because people understood the limits of it. And in 2015, people are forgetting their history.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.